Coming up on this episode of the Leadership Lounge.
Never give up on your dream. I think that when I look back on our career, a bank tell us one time, the only reason you guys are actually even in business still is because you're the most tenacious people I've ever met. You just never gave up.
Welcome to Leadership Lounge. My name is Mitch Slater, Executive Director, UBS New York City, and I'm joined by my colleague, Saman Sami, First Vice President, Wealth Management from Dallas, Texas. And the best way to contact us is by emailing mitchslater@ubs.com or samansami@ubs.com. Our guest is not affiliated with UBS.
And on this show, we sit down with some of the world's most accomplished business leaders. We go beyond the headlines to explore their stories, the decisions that shape their success, and the leadership insights that drive growth. If you're an entrepreneur or leader looking for real-world wisdom, you're in the right place. And we have a great, great show today. Joining me is Grace Barnard and Dane Wormwell. Sami, why don't you start us off?
Thanks for joining us today. Dane, let's start with you. Tell us the beginning of how you started NIW companies and some of the problems that you were trying to solve early on.
Sure. So actually, it started in an Italian restaurant. So I've known Grace at that stage for quite a while. And I was in AI back in, 1998, a little premature maybe. And we were sitting down talking dinner, and I was sort of frustrated about where I was and all the rest of it. And she started talking about the life insurance world. And I was like, what the heck are you talking about? I mean, it's like, let's just go and look at dust or something because it's that interesting, right? So she started to describe some of the advanced techniques and stuff that she was involved in. And I said, wow, that's interesting. It sounds like a really dysfunctional industry. And then in my ignorance, I started sort of drawing on, those Italian table mats that are paper, and you just start drawing on them. So I wish we'd kept the wretched thing, but we wrote this business plan. She said, you know what? We need to start a company. And I tell people this because I'm about as entrepreneurial as a brick. So the idea of me jumping out of the corporate world and starting a company.
Well, and doing it, I love, because typically the story is cocktail napkin, right?
This was the whole table.
You did it on the whole table.
Yeah, no, we ran out of crayon. I was the best three-year-old there.
I love that.
It was like the Macaroni Girl tablecloth, paper one. Yeah, he had a crayon.
Writing on, right? Long story sideways, you get these inflection points in your life where you get nudged in a different direction. And I always say to people, 99 times out of 100, I would have said, no, I'm not doing this. But that one moment, that one conversation, and it was like, what the hell, let's just do this. So that was the birth of NIW. It was, we were trying to do two things. One was, Grace is very adamant that the industry is not, but should be client-centric. And so she, a new investor world came, I'm going to change this world. That's how original we were. But we'd had some cocktails, what can I tell you? But the other thing, from a client point of view, our business started off on one thing and evolved. But it started off with the uber wealthy. They're people who have been incredibly successful. And the irony of the tax system is you could go to Vegas the day before you die and gamble everything away, and that's okay. But you can't give it to your kids. So the estate tax issue is what we are solving. Well, wealthy people are interesting because they're always in the game. They're always trying to buy another building, trying to do a new business, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. The idea of taking some of that working capital and putting it into a boring old life insurance policy is just not attractive to them. So there's this concept, premium finance, that's been around since the 60s. And it's not new, but my industry, and you can see how I ended up here, was I was historically in fiber optics, so clearly a natural career progression, right? But it was run by engineers. And I always joke that engineers knew a sales and marketing person was lying because their lips were moving. So you had to prove everything with data. So of course, I didn't know anything about life insurance. So I sort of said, where's the data? Because it's the only thing I thought sounded intelligent. And that was the problem. And although this concept was not new, it had not really been rigorously battle tested. And so the only benefit I brought to the picture was asking the dumb questions because I didn't know any better. So we formed the company and then exited the business for about 18 months while we rebuilt the program around the way we would want to see it. And Grace had a bunch of clients who wanted to do it, but I think we lost almost all of them over that time period where we reconstructed the program around, I'll call it sound engineering or sound finance principles. And so for the first 5 years, it was ghastly because we were saying things that nobody wanted to hear about the risks and the things that could go right, but also the things that could go wrong. And our illustrations were more conservative than everybody else. So, you know, for me as a non-entrepreneur, starting a business and not pulling a salary for 4 or 5 years, it was a horrible experience. I mean, the number of times I wanted to give up. But you get to the point of no return. I always make the analogy, you jump out of the plane and you're making the parachute on the way down. At some point, you realize you better complete the parachute, right? And so we did that. And eventually, as in, I think, most businesses, you get your first lucky break. And we got this case that finally got us into having positive cash flow, which was a novel experience at that point. I think we even had a paycheck at that point. That was new. But what happened was, well, as soon as you'd done one, the next one became easier and easier and so on. And gradually, people started to see, is this a safe pair of hands? And all we're really doing in terms of the client pain point is, hey, if you're wealthy, you're going to pay a big tax bill in some shape or form. Life insurance pays that tax bill, but they hate paying for life insurance. Let's use financing as a way to get that life insurance and still pay the tax bill. It was more efficient for clients. So that's how we started.
So, Grace, before NIW really took off, what shaped you as an entrepreneur? What were there experiences or mentors early in your life that influenced how you were able to lead?
Oh, well, my father was my biggest influence. And I was very fortunate. He was in the women's clothing business. And I come from a family of 5 girls. So on my mother's side, her family was very well off. And on my dad's side, his family was land rich, but cash poor.
Right.
And so it was a very unique environment to grow up in because I got to experience both sides of it. But the interesting thing about my father was he would take each one of us on one of his business trips. And every time we would go, I would go sit and watch him present to people. And he obviously owned his own business, so he was an entrepreneur. And I got to grow up in that environment and experience that environment. Because he was in the women's clothing business, my mother didn't want us in that business. And so she said, do something different. Well, she was an interior decorator. And so there was a little bit more upscale than the women's clothing business. And so my sister and I started a jewelry business and ended up doing that through the World Trade Center. So I was my senior year of high school, 18 years old. My sister was 19. And so that's how we started.
Where did you grow up?
Highland Park in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, okay. Okay. And I'd ask you, obviously, in the UK, you grew up?
Grew up in the UK. Yeah. I always answer people with no fixed abode because I was sent off to boarding school as far away from my mother as she could possibly get me.
Okay.
And then she kept moving around, and wherever I was at school, it seemed to be the furthest point away from her. So grew up in the UK, moved around a lot. I always say the residual family members there are in the Midlands, literally right in the middle, so near Stratford-on-Avon and all that good stuff. And then had this kind of fleeting relationship when 3M brought me over to the U.S. And I really kind of enjoyed the U.S. business culture because it was taking chances, whereas my perspective of the U.K. was it was playing not to lose. And that's very different. And so part of the reason when Grace said, let's just form a company, it was like, you know, I think the American dream and the entrepreneurial spirit is much more alive, I think, than most people realize. But I wanted part of that. And it was, you know, both terrifying and exciting, but that's how we kind of ended up in this position.
This is for both of you. You eventually scaled this into a very significant company before exiting. What were some of the hardest leadership?
Yeah. I think from my perspective, it was trying to find that fine line between getting the people that were working for you to want to do that, see the same vision that you had and follow those goals. But that's a really difficult thing to do because you're typically talking about people that get paid a salary and it's a very different mindset that they have. And they don't typically follow your same dream about what you want the company to do. And they don't always have the same work ethic that you do. So I think from my perspective, that was the most difficult thing was to try to figure out how to inspire them to go alongside the way we wanted to do it. Walk away from a commission check if it wasn't the right business decision, if it wasn't good for the client. That's, I think, from my perspective, that was the most difficult part of running a business, is ethics-wise.
What about you, Dan?
I always used to, you know, when you're a kid, you sort of see yourself as the general leading the charge and all that stuff. And you realize very quickly that will only get you so far. And I think, so building on what Grace said, finding the right people, but also the people who were willing to go the extra yard, and then letting them do it. And so part of the thing, if you think about when you start a company, you're pretty much doing everything. You know, I always joked, I was a CEO and janitor, and everything in between. And as you start to bring on team members, you kind of filter through the ones that are just there to pick up a check versus those who are really willing to give everything to the company and are passionate about it. And you're looking for that passion because they're the ones that will go the extra yard, see the problem, try and fix the problem, and articulate it. But what you need to be able to do is let them fail from time to time. You know, you learn most, unfortunately, from your mistakes. But if you mollycoddle them or control everything, that's not going to happen. And so you're fiercely passionate about this. I always joke, you know, I've had one mistress, and it was this business, right? Mm-hmm. And you're passionate about it, but you know how fragile businesses are. You know, you only have to do a couple of things wrong, and they can go south really quickly. And you know it. Every January 1, you wake up with that feeling. But you have to let the team grow. Mm-hmm. You have to let them grow into the role and think like a business owner. So we had to try and get them to do that. And that just took time. And it was the mistakes, I think, was allowing that to happen and letting it flush through.
You know, a lot of founders struggle with letting go as their company grows. You know, it's very typical. So how did you evolve from being the person doing everything to building this leadership team that could scale the business?
You go first,
Grace.
Or do you want me?
I was very lucky because I found somebody that I thought was very ethical, very passionate, and shared a lot of the same mindset that I had. So from one department on the sales side. So I was really lucky. I started mentoring him for about 5 years. I mentored him. Ultimately, having the discussion about hopefully one day he would take over and do what I was doing, run what I was running. I think the more difficult letting go was probably on the marketing side, because that's more of a, you know what it is and you know the message you're trying to convey, and finding people that can actually get that message out to the rest of the world is much more difficult. So that was a little bit more difficult. And I'm finding that a lot harder to let go of than I was the sales role. But it's hard. You have to find the right person, for sure.
Yeah.
You have to find the right people that will.
And you have to train them.
And you've got to train them.
Right.
Yeah. So that's difficult.
Yeah, I think if I look back on our 26 years of being in that business, that's something we didn't do well, right? Because the danger is, because you're both the owner and you're in the business and you're passionate about it, you tend to, and because you've taken the risk, you tend to be quite forceful about it. And so you overbear more than you should do. And so what somebody once said to me, and I think it's wise advice, if you're the only one talking, you've lowered the intelligence of the room. And because everybody's just listening, and then you get a bunch of doers as opposed to thinkers. So I think we didn't do that as well as we should have done. But we recognized that if we were going to be more than just a bunch of people with a few clever ideas, and basically I'll call it a family business, if it was going to scale to anything more than that, we had to start to get other people to challenge those ideas. So it's kind of difficult when sometimes some of your teammates come in and say, you know, you're basically being a dumbass. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh. And so I found that we had to learn to be much more humble. We had to learn to recognize we didn't have all the good ideas, and sometimes that was painful. Yeah. For other entrepreneurs listening, what are a few leadership habits or disciplines that you believe separate great operators from average ones?
From my perspective, I think ethics has to be the number one thing because you can't grow a business if your reputation isn't there, no matter what type of business it is. Mm-hmm. People want to come to places that they believe in the leadership, they believe in the message that you're conveying, and that they know that you're going to stand behind it. And in the, and you guys know this, being in the financial services industry, there are so many bad people out there that one bad person and everybody becomes the pariah. So right. If you remember Bernie Madoff, it was like, then nobody wanted to let anybody manage their money. So reputationally, when you talk about people's finances, which is the business we were in, that's a very, very emotional conversation to have with people, and they're very distrusting. So if you don't stand behind your ethics, then I think it's impossible to grow a business in that financial services market.
Yeah, true. So, you know, you ultimately went through a very successful exit. So let's, as we wrap things up towards the end of the show, I want to talk about what that experience was like from a personal standpoint, preparing for it, going through it, and the moment after the deal closed.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because you're looking at somebody who went through the dot-com bubble, right? So our industry started to become M&A very hot. I started to believe, and I think Grace and our other co-founder started to believe, that we'd taken the business as far as we could go without needing help. So it was a timing issue. We recognized that the market cycle was right. I mean, you can be double the business in the wrong cycle and get less value. So timing was one thing. Preparing the business, most people don't prepare the business well. And so as a consequence of that, they don't get the value. So we spent 2 years getting the business ready. And then the cycle itself, you have to approach the deal willing to walk away at any moment in time. And you, so what happens is kind of like you get the IKEA effect. You're kind of engrossed in it. And you go down paths you shouldn't go down. And the deal is not as good as it should be. So you need to be mentally preparing it like you would a sale, not like your business, because you get too emotional about it. Afterwards, I always think I probably never checked my bank balance more in that morning when the wire was happening than the previous 3 years. It was a very strange feeling. A, elation that, hey, look, we were lucky, we made it. But also, hey, oh, this has actually happened, and we no longer own this puppy. It's our baby's left the house, right, kind of thing. So it was very interesting, but it also meant that we, from my point of view, one of my major, major life goals was financial independence. So the life goal and being able to achieve one of my charitable goals at the same time was like, hey, wow. I mean, I've got an amazing spouse and wife who actually likes me for who I am, which is remarkable. But I've also got a couple of major life goals achieved at the same time, so I was really, really pleased.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we have to dive into this topic. Philanthropy is very important to you. One of the things I love about what you've done after the exit is supporting the Saving the Redwoods League out of California. Tell us what it is and why our listeners should care about it, and what motivated you to get going on it.
So, a couple of things. One of my most irritating nephews. Cousins, said to me once, tell me, Dane, how's the world going to know you even existed? And I went, ooh, that's a bit harsh. So all of us want to make an impact in some way, shape, or form. And I always feel that we're on this planet to improve ourselves and leave humanity, however incrementally small, in a better place than when, don't just be a taker, be a giver as well. And for me, when I was a child, actually, I actually went out to the Redwoods, and they made a deep, deep impact on me. It was just, there's something magical about place. Don't know really how to describe it, but everybody says the same thing. There's something special here. But people don't realize that, for example, save the Redwood tree itself is almost immortal. It has much more complex DNA than humans, but it has the highest capture of CO2 of any forest in the world per acre. It has unique habitats, it's all sorts of things. I mean, even down to weird stuff, like I'm finding out that it captures the fog that comes in off the ocean and turns it into rainwater. What's California short of? Water. Right. Mature trees are fire barriers. All these good things. But it started with, I have to joke about this. When we were in the really dark period of NIW's early days, I remember having one of my few ever panic attacks and going, God, we get through this, I'll promise I'll do something. Well, as we got closer and closer to the sale, you kind of go, I better remember that promise, or it could be a very short exit. I mean, a lightning bolt spikes me the next day. So, but what got closer and closer was this, what the hell am I going to do? And it kept coming back to the tree. So I actually challenged my children. I said, find me a charity that's established, has a high efficiency ratio, and has something to do with trees. And so off they went, and they came back. And the one, as soon as the Save the Redwood League came up, that's the one. So that's how it happened.
And for those that want to learn more, sorry, we've onboarded this on the UBS Optimus Foundation. So
And there's a terrific video that we will link for those of you that are listening on our podcast, or for those of you that are watching this, we will have a link to this video because it's truly incredible. So we'd love to end this show with a question I call the billboard question, which I kind of borrowed from Tim Ferriss's Tribe of Mentors. So you could each answer this. If you could put one message on a billboard that every entrepreneur in the world could see every single day, what would it be? I'll start with you, Grace.
Never give up on your dream. I think that when I look back on our career, we had a bank tell us one time, the only reason you guys are actually even in business still is because you're the most tenacious people I've ever met. You just never gave up. And you should have gone bankrupt, you know, years before. And so that always stuck with me. I always thought we stuck with it. We stuck it out. We did it. And you just have to keep, I like to call it plodding forward.
That's a great message.
That's a great one, yeah.
Step forward.
I always say dream big, just like Grace said, be careful of your dreams because that's the guiding passion, but it will also consume you. But learn from your mistakes. You know, be the chief coach. I always say, be Jean-Luc Picard, don't be Captain Kirk.
I love that.
Yeah.
So that wraps up this episode of the Leadership Lounge. Thank you so much, Dane Manuel and Grace Barnard, for sharing your insights, leadership perspective, and the meaningful work that you're both so passionate about. I love that. And as I mentioned before, we'll be including links in the show notes to the great cause, the Save the Redwoods League, as well as information on how to find it through the UBS Optimus Foundation page. We encourage you to take a moment to explore and support the important mission. So thank you for listening to the Leadership Lounge with Mitch Slater and my co-host, Saman Sami, powered by UBS. And we look forward to bringing you more conversations with inspiring leaders like today. See you next time. Thank you for joining us on the Leadership Lounge with Mitch Slater and Saman Sami, powered by UBS. We hope you enjoyed today's conversation and gained valuable insights to fuel your own success journey. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and share the episode with anyone looking to grow as a leader. And stay tuned for more exclusive stories and strategies from the world's most inspiring business minds. Until next time, keep leading with purpose.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary, provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.